Good morning, everyone. Hope everyone had a nice sleep. I'd like to start off by responding to some questions that we've received. There was a question concerning the retreat talks. Where would they be available? They'll be available on the TNI website. How long after?
As soon as I get them in, probably within the next week or two, on our audio page.
Okay. So they'll be available there for you if you'd like to download them and listen to them again. There was a question about eyes in terms of practice. Do we sit with the eyes open? Do we sit with the eyes closed or somewhere in between? Many different traditions have different teachings in terms of what to do with the eyes. In the Zen tradition, you tend to sit with your eyes open and you might be sitting against a blank wall. In our tradition, we tend to sit with the eyes closed. But it's also possible and quite fine to sit with the eyes just slightly open, with the gaze focused on the ground and the gaze soft. You're not looking around, because that will stimulate the mind, but if that feels more comfortable and helps maintain wakefulness, then that would be a perfectly useful way to orient your eyes. So you have a lot of options, okay? The one challenge if you were in this room with your eyes wide open would be, of course, there's all these things to see, and so that's why we're suggesting eyes just slightly open and gaze focused down. So hopefully that responds to that question. There was a question about the role of the breath in both Vipassana and Shamatha or Samadhi practice. In Samadhi or Shamatha practice, the breath is the sole object of your attention. You are trying to maintain your focus on the breath, and when the mind wanders off, as soon as you notice that, you bring the mind back to the breath. So the breath is the sole focus. In Vipassana practice, we start off focusing on the breath, but if the mind is pulled to a thought or a sound or a sensation in the body, then we allow the awareness to go to wherever the attention has been pulled, and we stay there until we see the changing nature of what the attention, the mind, has been pulled to. As soon as that is clear to us, then we come back to the breath, and we stay with the breath until the mind is pulled somewhere else. So the breath is not the goal. To stay with the breath is not the goal of the meditation. Coming back to the breath just brings us back into the present moment with presence, and then we observe where the mind wanders next. So it's very different in terms of the use of the breath in the two practices. I'm curious, just as a show of hands, how many of you are finding it really difficult to do this practice over the last few days? Actually, a goodly number of you. Okay. I want to reassure you that this is normal. Okay. This is a difficult practice because the mind resists being trained. And when I used to start to teach this practice, many, many years ago, I was doing it in the context of my psychotherapy practice, and I was teaching it one-on-one. And in the doing of that, I discovered something that's been known for about 2,600 years. It doesn't tend to work so well if you do it one-on-one. Why is that? If I had 10 people in my practice that I was teaching this practice to, they'd come in for their 50-minute appointment, and I'd give them instruction, and we'd talk about the practice, and then I'd give them something to go home and work on. And very quickly, in often 3 or 4 weeks, 8 or 9 out of the 10 would be coming back in saying, "Bill, it's me. I can't do this probably. Everybody else can do it, but it's me. I'm stupid. I'm not competent or capable of doing this." And I'd reassure them and say, "No, it's just difficult. Hang in there." But often they would get quickly filled with doubt and discouragement. And then we'd go back to the style of therapy I was originally trained to do. 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10 would hang in through the difficulty, and then, of course, their progression through the therapy was quite rapid, something I'd never seen before. So I want to bring that up in the context of discussing what are called the 5 hindrances. They're called the five hindrances because these are aspects of the mind, if we are not aware when they arise, will hinder our ability to be present to what's unfolding moment to moment. And given that these hindrances have been coming up in retreats over the course of 2,600 years, there's a pretty good chance they'll have visited or will be visiting you during the course of this retreat. So what are these hindrances? Because if we can be conscious and aware of them, then they just become objects of meditation. It's only when we don't see their arising and they kind of envelop the mind and take it over that they are hindrances. So what are the five hindrances? Well, the first two are desire and aversion. And you might think of them as flip sides of a coin. Desire is, of course, wanting something that we don't have, and aversion is not something that we do have. So you might be sitting here, and the sitting may be seeming really long, and you watch the desire arise in the mind, oh, I wish they'd ring the bell. I want to do some walking meditation, or I'm feeling hungry. I want to be go and get a snack, or I wish it was lunchtime. Desire is going to arise. It's the wanting mind. If you don't notice that that's desire arising, then you will believe that you want something, and then that could move you to perhaps instead of doing a period of sitting, if the desire to have a cup of tea was strong, you might instead go and have a cup of tea because you got caught in the desire. Aversion is the flip side of that. You're sitting here, and it's just like, oh, these sittings are interminable. I can't stand this anymore. I've got to get up and leave. That's the mind filled with aversion. And it could be an aversion about what's happening here in the room. It could be aversion to the food. It could be aversion to what's going on in your room. I don't like the bed, or I wish I had a private washroom. There are so many things that the mind can be aversive to. And again, if we don't notice that that's just aversion rising in the mind, we might think, well, this is probably just not the place for me. I'll go somewhere else. So really be on the lookout for desire and aversion. The next two hindrances are also two sides of a coin, you might say. One of them, I'm sure many of you have experienced this retreat, is sleepiness. You know, it's often called sloth or torpor, which I really like that name because it really, you know, the three-toed sloth, I've seen that where they fire guns beside them and they just don't budge. They're so slothful, okay? And so, but it often manifests in our practice as a dull, thick mind or actually moving into sleepiness. And so it's workable if you're aware of it. If you're not aware of it, of course, what will happen? You fall asleep. But if you notice sleepiness arising, there are some steps you can take, particularly in the meditation hall, to work skillfully with sleepiness. So the first step is to just when you notice that sleepiness is getting strong, straighten up the spine. It's often referred to as popping the spine. And what that does when we straighten up, we bring a bit more energy in the body that often facilitates wakefulness. Now, if you're falling asleep again, you might again try popping the spine. But if you've done it two or three times and the sleepiness is still strong, probably that won't be adequate. So then the next step is actually to open your eyes a crack, what I was talking about earlier, but now in terms of maintaining wakefulness. Because when you open your eyes a little bit, just a crack, it lets in a little light or energy, and that can help maintain with the wakefulness. So then you might continue your practice with the eyes open, gaze focused on the floor, and really that might be how you would finish that sitting. If you close your eyes, make sure you don't do it after 2 or 3 minutes because you'll go right back to sleep. If opening your eyes a crack is still not enough, then feel fine about coming to a standing position. I can remember retreats in California at Spirit Rock where there's 100 yogis, and if it was a really hot day, at the end of a sitting, I'd open my eyes, and a third of the room are standing. So these are experienced yogis. So there's nothing aversive or a problem about coming to a standing position. If our goal is to be awake to what's happening in the body-mind process, then you will be achieving that goal standing up. you won't be achieving that goal sitting in your chair or on your bench or your zafu sleeping. So feel no judgment about coming to a standing position. And if you come to a standing position, you have some choices. Some people can stand quite easily with their eyes closed and maintain their balance. So if that's possible for you, then feel fine about closing your eyes and continuing the practice standing. And Daryl talked about the standing practice yesterday. But if standing with your eyes closed means you really feel unsteady, then again, just open your eyes a crack. Keep your gaze focused on the floor. And if you're falling asleep standing with your eyes closed, then definitely open your eyes, keep them focused on the floor, and continue the practice standing. And if you've come to a standing position, what I've seen is that people will stand up for 2 or 3 minutes, they'll feel a little more awake, they'll sit back down and go right back to sleep. So if sleepiness is strong and you come to a standing position, stay standing for a good, you're not looking at a watch, but stay standing for a good period of time, at least 5 minutes, until some sense of wakefulness or energy comes back into the body. And then you might sit down, but if you go back to sleep, then probably it's wise to finish the rest of the sitting standing. In Asia, when I've practiced there, often we'll have one period of meditation every day where it is just standing meditation. So people get the idea standing is quite fine. So that's sleepiness and how you work with it. So if sleepiness is not enough energy in the body, the flip side of that will be restlessness. It feels like you've got so much energy in the body that if you don't get up and move, you're going to explode. I've had people say that. They just said, I've just got to move. That means usually there's an excess of energy that has not been balanced by concentration. So the energy is strong, but the concentration is not balanced to is not strong enough to keep it in balance. What I encourage my students to do, if you really feel that intense restlessness, is then temporarily restrict the focus of your attention to just the breath, not doing full insight practice. Then you're actually cultivating concentration. And as the concentration starts to arise, at one point you'll notice that it balances the energy. And when the energy and the concentration are in balance, that sense of just being overwhelmed by the energy is not there. And then you can open up and go to the full practice again, regular insight practice. So that's restlessness and how you might work with that. The fifth of the hindrances can actually be, I think, the most sneaky, because it can sneak up on us and we don't even notice it. And the fifth of the hindrances is doubt. And doubt can take many forms. It can take doubt about the practice. Maybe I should be doing TM or Sufi dancing or some other meditative practice. That's the right one for me. I shouldn't be doing Vipassana. Or it might take the form of doubt about the teachers. If I had a different teacher, then probably my practice would be flowing. But most commonly, the doubt is about ourselves. I can't do this. I'm not capable. Everybody else, I'm sure, because the comparing mind arises, at one point or other during this retreat, you've looked around the room, and probably the mind has said, everybody here looks like the Buddha when they're sitting, and I'm barely managing to stay in my seat. And so there's doubt about me as being capable of doing this. So expect that doubt can arise. If doubt arises, it is just another state of mind that we can be aware of. We don't have to be controlled by the doubt. So if you start to notice doubt arising about any of the things I've talked about, see if you can just recognize, oh, that's the doubting mind, and observe the consequences of the doubting mind so you're going to learn about it, because it won't just arise here. It will arise in all areas of your life. But here we get a chance to actually really pay attention to it, observe it, understand its characteristics. So should it arise in the rest of life, then we can learn how to work with it. And part of why doubting mind arises is that most of us, and I kind of alluded to this yesterday, but I'd like to touch on this. Most of us have not been conditioned to believe that we are a capable but also worthy of love and care. Our minds are so harsh and critical. They'll judge us as being not capable, not lovable. And we need to really bring, and Daryl touched on this yesterday, a kind mindfulness, a kind loving care to ourselves when we're doing this practice. Now, when I say that, it doesn't mean that when it might be uncomfortable to sit, we immediately adjust posture because that's caring. But really be kind to yourself. Watch for the judging mind arising, sometimes triggering doubt, often feeling somehow less than, and see if you can just recognize, oh, that's the judgmental mind. I just need to be kind to myself. And we have, of course, a practice called loving kindness that is one of the practices that we can engage in to allow ourselves to train our mind to be more loving and caring rather than its often common habits of criticism and judgment. Okay? If the doubt were to get strong enough and you don't recognize it as doubt, that the mind starts to say, I just can't do this. What's the point of me staying here? I might as well leave. Before that state of mind hijacks you and that intention leads you to leave the retreat, please contact one of us. It can be actually a significant learning opportunity to have someone work with you with doubt so that you can really understand doubt and not have it control you. So we really want to emphasize that. If doubt ever gets so strong that you think you might end the retreat, please contact one of us. We'll be glad to spend some time with you teaching you how to work with that. And it can be a real useful learning opportunity. So are there any questions about what I've been talking about before I continue? Yes?
These five hindrances, are they in reference to mindfulness or life in general? Are they more like
life? They come up all through life, but in the context of a retreat practice, when we're really paying attention to the mind, we get to see them more clearly. So that's why this is a wonderful opportunity to work with them. So I'm never unhappy if one of the hindrances arises with one of my students when I'm teaching, as long as they recognize that that's what's happening and then learn to work with it. You learn to work with it in the context of the retreat environment, then you're much more aware of when it will arise, and it'll be less likely that those intentions that come from the hindrances will be less likely to control you out in daily life.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
And I have one.
Sure.
A lot of what we've been talking about seems to be, certainly not rules, but more things to be aware of. Because in life, and even in our mindfulness practice, there's a certain amount of judgment that's necessary in order for us to make good decisions, to put ourselves in the right situations in life. So are they things like doubt and aversion? We may have those to bad people in our lives or bad situations, and we have to have those to create a good life for ourselves. But are they things that we just need to be aware of? Not eliminate, right? But just be aware of them.
Well, first of all, our goal is not to be judgmental, but we don't want to be brain dead. We want to cultivate what's often referred to in this practice as discriminating wisdom. The wisdom to see what leads to what. When we act in a certain way, what are the consequences of that? Often what really is important to be aware of is the motivation behind our intention. If our motivation behind intention is coming from greed, hatred, or delusion, then those kinds of behavior tend to lead to suffering for ourselves and others. If our intentions or our motivations are loving kindness, compassion, and generosity, the consequences of those kinds of motivations tend to lead to happiness for ourselves and others. So we don't want to judge, but we do want to see clearly. That's what seeing clearly means, seeing what leads to what.
What did you say? Discriminating.
Wisdom. Discriminating wisdom.
I like that a lot better than the word
judgment. Because it's very different. See, judgment is right or wrong, good and bad. Discriminating wisdom is coming from that place of clear seeing.
I like that so much more.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And so there was a second part of your question, and I got caught in the first part. I've answered it all? Okay.
Yep.
Yes.
And I guess my question is it hierarchical in the sense that you should feel some mastery over the concentration before you're going to insight? Or is it free form? Or should you have some sort of intent before that you'd like to devote this thing to one rather than the other? Or do you not restrict it?
Yes and no. a certain level of concentration in the mind is useful before we shift to insight practice. Because if the mind is constantly going here and there and there's no concentration, then it would be very difficult to really see clearly what's happening in the insight practice. So we want to have a certain level of concentration. And that's why on Thursday evening, Daryl guided us in a tranquility concentration practice to kind of calm and focus the mind a little bit. But concentration on its own will never lead ultimately to insight. And actually, we can get caught in concentration practice because as we get really concentrated, the Buddha had certain levels of concentration he called jhanas, and some people go on retreats where they're purposely trying to concentrate the mind. Well, it can actually be so pleasant when the mind gets really concentrated that we kind of stay with the concentration and then we don't shift to insight to really see the full nature of what life is about. But a certain level of concentration is useful. Usually, but in a short retreat like this is not always possible, we want to have a level of concentration where the hindrances, what I just talked about, are no longer so controlling us. It, usually at that stage, it is advisable then to shift to insight practice once you've reached that. But again, this is a short retreat. Many of you are new to the practice. We're trying to give you a broad overview of what's going on. So there was a short period of concentration, and then we've moved into the insight practice. But at any time during the retreat, if the mind feels so agitated and unsettled, just like I was talking about with the restlessness, it is always skillful to say, maybe this retreat or this sitting, I just need to focus on a little concentration until the mind feels a little more settled. And then when that happens, then I can go back to insight practice. Does that help? Okay. And was there another question? Yes.
It's kind of it's kind of continuing her question. I heard that, and I was wondering if it was true, I heard that whichever you practice first, may it be morality or concentration or wisdom, it one can help the other, not in a sequence, but let's say like I practice concentration first, it can help Sila and it can help wisdom, and then one hand can wash the other independently. Is that true?
Well, concentration and insight practice to benefit each other, and they benefit our skillful actions for sure. Some people have a more of a proclivity to want to do concentration rather than insight, but I think ultimately Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is the man who's translated all the Pali teachings, probably the most accessible teaching, has looked through all the teachings that he's translated, and at no point does the Buddha say strong, really strong jhanic concentration is necessary to achieve enlightenment. And so we want to concentrate the mind because if it's not concentrated, doing insight practice is going to be too difficult. But be aware of the limitations of pure concentration. Okay? And when you're talking about morality, when the Buddha was teaching householders, that was often the first thing he would teach before any meditation. We teach them morality, to learn how to live in a social environment in a skillful way. Because that, as I said, quoting Jack Kornfield, it's hard to sit and meditate after a day of lying and stealing. So a certain level of morality is necessary, or the mind gets whizzed up. Imagine if you were going around frequently lying to people, and then what happens in your life is you have to start remembering, who did I tell what to? Because my story keeps changing. So you sit down on the cushion, and of course the mind is all revved up with this. And if I've been stealing, well, am I going to get caught? There's no, it doesn't lead to peace of mind when you do that. So that's why morality is really an important, I think, focus as we move into the practice. So they really are mutually beneficial. Yes, Bob.
So talking about meditating with your eyes open,
mm-hmm.
How do you go about blinking? For example, when I try to meditate with my eyes open, I'm so aware of blinking, and I don't know if I'm supposed to or not. If I just keep my eyes open, my eyes get dry and I want to blink, but then that's like chasing comfort maybe.
The blinking in this case is a physiological function. As you said, if you keep your eyes open, they get dry. There are medical conditions where people do not produce enough liquid in their eyes, and so they have to keep adding it. So it would be unskillful to try and keep your eyes, you know, open, look like Marty Feldman or something with them, you know, and not blinking, because the blinking actually lubricates the eye. So when blinking happens, this is not, oh, I'm trying to get comfortable. This is the body taking care of itself. Mm-hmm. So let that happen. Okay? Yes?
I've done some meditations. I've been doing my eyes open and looking out. And I understand the distraction for sure, because I kind of like it, because things become greener. After a while, things look luminous or something. So I like that. Does then my mind then wander too much and I'm not getting the benefit of the meditating? Or do I need to close my eyes, or can I just enjoy that?
Well, you could enjoy it for the moment, but is that going to help you see the truth of how life is? Because there's the short-term pleasure of seeing a sight and now seeing another sight. It may seem kind of far away now, because you're if you're new to the practice and you're feeling all the discomfort in the body and the mind's wandering and difficult emotions, and you go, how is this leading me to ultimately feel a sense of contentment and peace? In that respect, you have to have a little trust of the practice that that's the goal. Because otherwise, if you don't have that understanding that putting myself through this difficult process, it's like putting ourselves in a pressure cooker when we come on retreat. Because we keep ourselves separate from all the other things that we engage the mind in. That's why we're asking you not to read or check your cell phone or your, go online for things. So that when we restrict our focus and stop looking outward at the parts of the world, we get to have a more intimate understanding of how this body-mind process works. And as that understanding grows, that manifests as change in behavior in terms of how we live our life. So we start to, as we see clearly the interaction of the mind and body in this context, in our daily life, we start to see things arising in the mind, and we see the consequences of acting out those intentions, and we see that that leads to either suffering for me or suffering for someone else, and I realize, oh, that's something that probably is not wise for me to do. And so our behavior starts to change over time as our practice grows. spending time away from the busyness of life and just focusing on pleasant looking at the trees and hearing the birds, it may make this short-term experience more pleasant, but it's ultimately not going to lead to wisdom and the ultimate freedom that we can have. So that's really how I would respond to that question, okay? All right. We've been exploring some of the perceptual distortions that keep us believing that there is something that endures over time called an I, me, or a mine. And I want to emphasize, even if you have some experience, you're not going to, if I can use this word, get it all this retreat, okay? In fact, the mind ultimately can't get it anyways. The mind, at some point, as your practice matures, actually becomes an impediment to realizing our ultimate freedom, because the mind, the conceptual mind, can't get it. However, I want to give you a metaphor or an image that, for me, has been so useful in my practice. And if you imagine these lights, if we had a recessed light in the ceiling here, and I put a piece of black paper and I taped it over the light, and even if the light was turned on, I wouldn't see any light coming through the black paper. This kind of is what we're like when we start off on our practice. There is freedom, but it's being blocked by the obscurations of the mind, its conditioning. And so we go on retreat, and maybe we have one or two insights into the nature of life that we weren't aware of before. And an insight in this context is a non-conceptual realization of something that was always there, but now we're seeing it. When we have, let's say, two insights, it's like we took an ice pick and poked two holes, small holes, in the black paper. Now there's a little light coming through. And then we maybe go on another retreat, or we're sitting in our daily practice, and we have some other insight, and it's like it pokes another hole. And over time, if we continue, and this is why it's so important to have a momentum of practice, not just coming on retreat and then not following it up and continuing to practice at home, but if there is a continuity and a momentum of practice, we start to see more and more holes being poked into the black paper. More and more light starts to come through. And then at some point, there's going to be one insight and the paper falls away and there's clear seeing. And that's why it seems that enlightenment is a sudden experience, but it's being prepared for by all these insights that arose before. So if you're finding it difficult, this retreat, and I'm assuming that many, if not most of you are, recognize that is the nature of this. Although there are times on retreat where we move into and the mind is quiet and content and it's just feeling joy in the body and the mind, but mostly it's challenging. And so that you're working on kind of poking some holes into the black paper to allow some of the light to come through. And so don't expect that you're going to have total enlightenment at the end of this retreat. If it does happen, that would be wonderful, okay? And some people with very little practice suddenly have these very strong and full realizations, but that tends to be the few. Most of us have to put a little energy and effort into doing it. So my hope for all of you at the end of this retreat is that you've got a few more holes in your black paper. There's a little more light shining through. And this won't be the ultimate light shining through, but you're building on this direction. Yes?
Are you enlightened? Is there any black paper on your light?
Yes, and if I was enlightened, I wouldn't be able to know it. Because if I was totally enlightened, then there would be no sense of Bill as being separate from the rest of life. So where would I be able to step out of that to look back and see?
And help us, I guess?
Well, we can help you without being fully enlightened. It's just I think of my role and as and all of Dharma teachers as we've just gone down the road a little further than you have. So we look back and we're seeing you walking along the road, and we, if we notice you going off to the left, we might say, you might want to come back a little bit more to the right. And if you're going off to the right, you might come a little bit more back to the left. And because we've walked that little bit further, we can look back and guide you.
But if you were, if you had no black paper left, you wouldn't know it?
You would be it. You could be it, but you wouldn't know it. Now, having said that, there's something called a tacit understanding. There's a kind of a non-cognitive realization, but it's not someone going around saying, "I'm enlightened."
I'd like a trophy.
That's right. That's my enlightenment trophy. No. It's more, I think, everybody else around that person knows it because of how they're experienced it. And that person, when they are that way, just moves through life with such an ease. Mm-hmm. Because there's no suffering, because the mind has opened up to everything. Ultimately, the fact that they are not their body and their mind, and that the body and mind are going to die, but they're not going to die. So once there's no fear of death, then there's freedom in life. Okay? Sorry, yes.
To speak to that, I've had someone come up to me and say, "You're so mellow," and I'm shocked to hear. So I think, as you said, others may see it and I can't.
I see it. You look really mellow.
Often what I hear from my students in the mindfulness program as they've reached a certain level and their behavior has started to change, they say, my kids are saying, if I let go of the meditation for a couple of days, it's my kids or my partner saying, "Mommy, you want to get back and meditate again? Because you're starting to act the way you were before, and we like it." Now, at the same time, in the early stages of the practice, those same kids, when the mother is trying to pull away and give some time to herself when she's only given to her kids, they're actually interrupting her meditation practice. But then at the halfway point, there's a shift. Okay. So I'm going to stop if there's any further questions, because we'll have another opportunity in the small groups and Daryl this afternoon. And I'd like to talk to you this morning about intention, because it's so important. Yesterday I reviewed what the Buddha called the five aggregates of clinging. Remember the five flowing, changing body-mind processes that we cling to as I, me, or mine when we're not seeing clearly the true nature of our experience. So there's the body with its five senses, and yesterday we discussed how readily we can identify with the body as being self, and we invited you to bring mindfulness to the experience of the body so you can see that it is not who you are, and actually how little control you have over its functions. So you might say, I can see that I'm not the body, but what about the mind? So as I discussed yesterday, the Buddha divided the mind into four components or aggregates: feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. So feelings in this context do not mean how do you feel about that or how are you feeling today. Feeling in this context is the quality of sense experience as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that's happening every single moment of our life, and the mind reacts to these different feelings in different ways. Although we won't be exploring feelings directly during this retreat, most people don't have too much difficulty seeing that these feelings are constantly changing from moment to moment, that they have no control over what feelings will arise. Maybe you're anticipating, for example, eating something and having a pleasant feeling, and you tasted it and it was very unpleasant. Okay, so most people can, I think, get a sense that feelings is not who I am. Most people don't have too much difficulty seeing that their perceptions are constantly changing and could not possibly be who we are. But the last two of the aggregates, however, mental formations and consciousness, those are the two aspects where the sense of self is most strongly identified. As a reminder, mental formations are the emotional, intellectual, and volitional aspects of the mind, and consciousness is the knowing quality. Consciousness kind of acts as a kind of a motion detector that when triggered by one of the six senses. And you say, six senses, what about, I thought we had five senses. In this tradition, the mind is considered to be the sixth sense organ. So eyes see, ears hear, minds think. Okay? And so consciousness just illuminates the corresponding sense field, the visual field, the auditory field, the cognitive field. That's what consciousness does. It does it without any interpretation, without any modification, without any attempt to control the process. Now, most of us tend to identify with consciousness more than any of the other aggregates. We believe I am conscious. That's me, myself, of what's happening moment to moment. An investigation of the selfless nature of consciousness could be the focus for a whole retreat. So we're not going to work with that. This morning I want to invite you to investigate volition, which is the stickiest of the mental formations. Volition, or intention, is the factor of mind that is concerned with the actualization of goals. One of its functions is to direct all the other factors of mind to achieve a certain result. We have a strong identification with being the doer of our actions. I decided to come to this retreat. I choose where I'm going to do walking meditation. I choose to get up and have a cup of tea or go to the bathroom or take a nap. We strongly identify as being the one who wills things to happen in our life. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. If we're to see through the illusion of self and recognize the selfless nature of experience, we need to see clearly that intentions arise and pass away based on causes and conditions, without a self as being part of, behind, or in control of the volitional process. It's all selfless. So we can see the selfless nature of our intentions. If we can come to see that, we can understand how the body mind can operate without a self kind of running the show. If we can't see that, we'll always believe that there's an I somewhere that is in control of what's going on. Now, there are two types of intentions we can investigate. Today, we're going to work at the grosser level with the intentions that occur prior to moving the body. With the accept of reflex actions, if I took a reflex hammer and hit your knee and your leg went out, that does not involve a mental intention. That's a reflex action. Every other action of the body, when I move my hand, when I open my mouth, when I turn my head, all of that is preceded by a mental event. We tell ourselves, I want to go to the bathroom, or I decided to get a cup of tea, or take a nap. But when we investigate the true nature of the experiences, we realize it's selfless and only arise because of causes and conditions. So, for example, you realize that you intend to go to the bathroom. Stop and ask yourself, who wants to go to the bathroom? Immediately observe your mind, and what you will discover is that the thought, I want to go to the bathroom, arose because your mind became aware of an unpleasant sensation in your bladder. And this unpleasant sensation of a full bladder triggered the thought, I want to go to the bathroom. In other words, the intention to go to the bathroom was conditioned by the sensations of the bladder. There was no independent self that made the decision to go to the bathroom. The thought arose because of the interaction of the body and the mind. Or you decide you want to take a nap. So stop and ask yourself, who wants to take a nap? When you investigate what's going on, you discover that there's a sensation of fatigue in the body, and the thought, I want to take a nap, was conditioned by the feeling of fatigue. There was no one that decided to take a nap. You're having a cup of tea with a cookie, and you become aware of the desire to have another cookie. It may have happened to you. Stop and ask yourself, who wants another cookie? When you investigate, you realize that when the cookie touched the tongue, there was a strong, pleasant, agreeable feeling as a consequence of that taste. And the thought, I want another, rose in the mind, conditioned by that pleasant feeling. There was no independent self that wanted another cookie. The positive feeling of the taste of the cookie triggered the intention to get another. So you get up and you move towards the cookie jar. But there happens to be a mirror right by, you're walking by. And as you look in the mirror, you see your image, and the thought arises, you're getting fat. Stop and ask yourself, who thinks they're getting fat? You investigate and you discover that the judgment arose as a consequence of the visual image in the mirror that was perceived by the mind as unpleasant. The unpleasant image triggered the thought, you're getting fat. There was no one who made that judgment. This might be followed by awareness of tightness of your clothing, you know, and how confining they feel. This might trigger the intention not to get another cookie. So if the intention not to get the second cookie was not as strong as the intention to get the cookie, okay, then the cookie will be gotten. If that intention is strong enough, then it will override the first intention and you go back down and you just finish your tea. There was no one who decided to get the cookie, no one who decided not to get the second cookie. The whole process can unfold without there being a self behind or in control of the process. Is that at least making sense? This also applies to our emotional states and the intentions that arise as a consequence of those emotions. We so readily identify with our emotions. I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm afraid. For example, the person sitting beside you in the meditation hall is moving a lot, maybe they're coughing, their breathing is really loud, and you start to feel anger or irritation arise. Stop and ask yourself, who's irritated? Look within your mind and you might discover thoughts arising that say, why can't they sit still? They're spoiling my meditation practice. There is an awareness of the body as being tense and tight. There may be awareness of the intention to move your bench or your zafu. There is no independent self that is irritated and wanting to move. The irritation is nothing more than the mind reacting in a conditioned way to stimuli it perceives as unpleasant. The response of the body to tense up was triggered by the reaction of the mind. The intention to move your bench, your zafu, was conditioned by the unpleasant physical and emotional states that have arisen. No one is in control of the process. So I said that there's two types of intention we can investigate. The grosser level, the intention of the body prior to moving. At a more subtle level, we can investigate the intention prior to the movement of thought. But in the context of this shorter retreat, we're not going to do that because we've got enough in the short time we have. So what I'd invite you to do today is, as you're in your practice this morning, pay attention to the arising of intentions. In sitting, you can pay attention to the arising of intentions to maybe just little intentions to adjust your posture if you're feeling a little uncomfortable, and you can explore that. Or the intention to scratch an itch. So you can see that there's no one deciding to scratch an itch. There was the unpleasant physical sensation, and that triggered the intention to scratch. And if you're aware of the intention before it has triggered your action, you can choose not to act on that intention. If the mindfulness is stronger than the intention, then the intention can just arise and pass away without you acting on it. This is what strengthening our mindfulness practice allows us to do more and more, both on retreat and more importantly in our life. As our mindfulness practice gets stronger, intentions will arise in our life, and if the mindfulness is strong and understands the potential consequences, the intention can arise and pass away without us acting on it. When walking and through the rest of the day, see if you can recognize intentions behind the things you do. We're not trying to recognize why the intentions arose or why we think and do what we do. We're just trying to recognize the selfless nature of intentions. Because when we achieve that awareness, then one of the holes in the black paper that the insights we can have is to understand how the body and mind can operate without there being something called a self behind or as part of or in control of the process. Yes.
Thank you.
I'm asking a lot of questions, but I'm a little confused. I have a really hard time with this concept of lack of self or lack of control.
Right.
Like, if I just eat 8 boxes of cookies every night and I just say, it wasn't my fault, Bill Knight said that it was some other factor, and I become 600 pounds, like, is that my fault?
Well, if we let go of fault, there is no one to be at fault. What would happen was the intention to eat cookies was always stronger than the awareness of what the consequence of eating the cookies was. Your mindfulness wasn't strong enough to see the intention to eat a cookie arise and let the intention arise and pass away. There's no one to blame. The intention to eat the cookies was stronger than your mindfulness to see the consequence of what eating the cookies would be, so the intention took over. If the mindfulness was stronger, it could see the intention and not give into it. Now, I'm conscious there's a lot of questions, and do we want to respond to them or just let everyone settle in for a bit? Are there questions specifically about what I've just been talking about that would get in the way of you looking for intention? Then I'll if those are the questions, you will have chance in the small groups to actually bring this up. Okay, and so I'll take 2 quick ones, and then I think I'd like to sit. Yes?
In relation to the struggle that she's having, I am as well. And for me, it arrives at the point that a decision is made. So I can be very aware of intentions and where they come from and the various steps. But who's making the decision?
The decisions arise.
No self. Right. When I arrive at the point of saying, well, I fully understand and I'm aware of everything that led to this predicament that I'm in, should I choose the cookie or not? At that second that I decide to choose the cookie, who's deciding?
No one's deciding. A decision is being made conditioned by the causes and conditions that preceded that. So if the causes or conditions are strong to get the cookie, and your mindfulness is not strong enough to see that that might be more cookies than you need, then you're going to eat the cookie. If the mindfulness is strong, you can see the intention to eat the cookie arise and just not act on it. No one has to be in control of the process. Rather than asking a question about this now, maybe to go and work with it, and then after when we reconvene, then you can, because you've now had some direct experience, because otherwise it's just the mind thinking about it. I'd like you to have the experience, and then the questions that arise from that experience, I think, would be much more usefully answered. Okay, the final one.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify what she said as well then. Does the intention to avoid discomfort it's greater than the intention to be mindful then? If you're willing to get that cookie and the cookie actually wasn't, if you were mindful, you'd realize I didn't need the cookie. Or if you're sitting here and you're like, well, I'm really tired, I feel really sleepy. And so your intention to avoid discomfort kind of compels you, and your mindfulness is not strong enough, so to speak.
Right. If the mindfulness is not strong enough, then the intention will be acted on. Mm-hmm. If the mindfulness is strong, the mindfulness sees the intention and then can decide whether to act on that intention or to let it go. Because when mindfulness is strong, it brings other factors of mind that are skillful with it.
Yeah, so something that my mentor always says is, it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility. And so that kind of seems to me, in my mind, to fit very well with that.
Okay, great. Thank you. So there's a lot of talk, so let's settle in.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org. www.mindfulnessmedia.org/donate.